ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hey there, Sana Qadar here from All in the Mind. Check out our new series, Forensic. It's all about the psychological tools and tricks that come with investigating crime.
He was setting the bombs off in subways, in the New York Public Library, in movie theaters.
When you're testifying in court, rather than having purely your own memory, you take on all these little bits and pieces of information from different sources.
All in the Mind, Forensic. Search for All in the Mind on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
A massive explosion in Bali.
We are very concerned that Australians will be amongst
them. The multinational force led by Australian troops has begun arriving in Dili.
Killed in Indonesia's Aceh province after an initial quake off the island of Sumatra.
Ratifying a major security treaty with Indonesia.
Prime Minister Paul Keating has announced that he will travel to Jakarta to sign the treaty.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese met with the Indonesian President Prabowo Subianto to finalise the agreement.
It might be our biggest near neighbour, but the character and soul of the Indonesian people are far less familiar to many of us here in Australia.
I mean, it's almost Hamish like the shadow puppet plays they're so famous for.
In this special episode, we're looking at how Indonesian identity is changing today.
The country's magnificent and rich history of literature, poetry and art.
How young Indonesians are wrestling with a sense of belonging in an increasingly interconnected and globalised world.
I'm Geraldine Doogue.
I'm Hamish McDonald. This is the fourth episode of Indonesia Rising, and we're leaving politics for a deeply personal insight into what it means to be Indonesian.
Yes, Hamish, look, this is where I was hoping we would get to the identity questions, because I think you've covered so widely. And I must tell you how many people have commented to me on the David Van Reybrouck, the Revolusi book, which obviously should be required reading for people in Australia. Just what you say it's a magnificent book and everybody says so. But again, it sort of reminding us of how far they have inserted themselves into the world's developments, if you know what I mean. And we just don't grasp that.
Well, I don't think we give them credit for it. And in a sense...
And do they give themselves credit for it?
Well, I think that's why the book Revolusi is so significant, because I think Indonesians have not given themselves credit for that. I think there is a clear answer to that. And David Van Reybrouck's invitation to the world and to Indonesia is to say, look, come at this again. Have a think again about these events. Have a think about what happened, not just in the 40s, but the 50s, and the way Sukarno and Hatta and others laid the ground for some of what was to come. And I think, you know, we are going to have to relook at Indonesia in Australia because they're so close. They are so big because the economy is growing. But as you say, we often don't think much about who these people are as a community, as a whole. You know, what is it that excites them? What gives them joy? What gives them meaning?
Dare I say, there are a lot of contradictions, aren't there, within Indonesia? I know we ought to be able to cope with them, but I don't know that we can. Even when you're there, you feel it. There's a lot of there's immensely strong nationalism. That's what really does hit you.
I think what's helpful for me to think about is the fact that as Indonesia marched towards independence, there were always these different currents that were driving that. So there were the communists, there were the nationalists, there were the Islamists. And somehow Sukarno folded all of these ideas into the constitution, into Pancasila, the five principles of Indonesian democracy. It's all still there and very much alive. It's alive in many ways in the politician that is Prabowo, that's now the president. You can see him grappling with those original concepts of the Indonesian nation, not to mention the physical disparateness of it as a nation, you know, stretching from West Papua to Aceh on the other side, the 16,000-17,000 islands, the hundreds of different languages.
But that's part of the trouble. I think it is bigger over there.
Yes.
I really do.
That's what I'm saying. Like, magnify whatever those instincts are that you might feel here and imagine sort of overlaying that across that vast archipelago. I think the conversation we're going to have today is really important, because when we talk about the politics or the business and the trade and all the rest of it, there is this kind of a misunderstanding maybe on some level. Like, why don't we get each other better? What is it that we don't quite trust? And, you know, there's particular features of Javanese culture, right, that are very polite.
They elliptical.
They won't necessarily say outright what they're thinking, and they'll talk about it quite openly as a difference between someone from Sumatra versus someone from Java. You know, the Javanese might see a Sumatran as being a bit loud and a bit brash and
blunt,
and a Sumatran might say, well, you know, the Java, well, they're Javanese, and that explains so much. And I think that's where we're going to try and give you perhaps a better understanding of Indonesia today. And I'm so thrilled, actually, you were able to join me down the line from Australia for this conversation with Lakshmi Pamunchak.
Yes, and she writes about sort of profound love, but she brings in myth and culture and politics. You can feel Lakshmi's thrill about her culture with all its perplexities.
Mm. But also the tension that she feels.
Oh, yes.
Her debut novel was called The Question of Red. She's one of Indonesia's leading literary lights. She's a poet. She's a novelist. Important to know that The Question of Red is set on Buru Island, where obviously under Suharto they sent many of the leftists and the communists to what was essentially, some describe it as a gulag. And she places a love story there in the sort of aftermath of this period. It's loosely based on the Mahabharata, which I think is also an important part of understanding Indonesian culture.
An absolute Hindu, a basic Hindu text, which I always found extremely difficult to follow.
But has been melded and evolved. So there is a separate Indonesian version of the Mahabharata. In any event, I think you will just love this conversation. Here she is, Lakshmi Pamunchak. Lakshmi Pamunchak, welcome to Global Roaming.
Hello. It's very nice to be here.
Thank you very much for doing this. And there's sort of a connection between you and Geraldine, because you've spent quite a lot of time in Perth.
That's right.
Yes, I have noted that you went to a very, we thought it was a very posh school called Presbyterian Ladies College in Perth. We were on the other side of the river, Lakshmi, and we had all sorts of views about girls like you.
I'm not sure I fit the bill at the time, you know. I thought I was always very different from everybody else. I think I might have been the only Indonesian in my year.
I wonder if you could offer our listeners your perspective on what it was like being educated in Australia. You had two different experiences. You had one as a student, but then one when you were a young mum living in Melbourne.
That's right.
And they were quite different experiences. How and why?
I went to Murdoch University during the golden years of Asian studies. And I'm really referring to a very particular moment in Australia under the Paul Keating government, when there was a genuine intellectual and political commitment to engaging with Asia. So not just economically, but also culturally and academically. So universities like Murdoch University, Australian National University, ANU, and Monash University had very, very strong, well-funded Asian studies programs. I mean, I remember Bahasa Indonesia was being taught. It was an elective in high school during that time. So I went to Perth to study at Murdoch. And for me, it was an extraordinary time, you know, because for the first time I had access to books and ideas about Indonesia that were simply not available at home under the Suharto regime. So intellectually, it was incredibly liberating. And socially, too. I mean, I found Australia, Perth in particular, even though it had a reputation for being, you know, a bit of a backwater. But it was very open and very curious and genuinely interested in difference. But when I returned in 1998 to Melbourne, it felt like a different country. But then John Howard was in power, and there was a noticeable shift in tone, a more inward-looking mood, a certain anxiety about identity, about borders, and figures like Pauline Hanson, for instance, were gaining prominence. And that changed the atmosphere. But I should also say that part of that shift may have been personal. I was no longer a student. I had a younger child. I had a young child. I was more vulnerable, more attentive to the texture of everyday life. And Melbourne, of course, is a very different city from Perth. So perhaps what I felt was both a real political change and a change in my own position in the world. But the contrast was unmistakable.
You must be aware that Pauline Hanson is more popular now than she ever has been.
Yeah, again, from a distance, from what one follows, it does seem that Australia, like many countries actually, is going through a period where you know, questions of migration, identity and social cohesion have become more charged. And from what little I've read, it seems that anti-immigration sentiment has become more visible at times, and that these pressures are also shaping mainstream political debates, especially around migration levels and cost of living. And I think those are not uniquely Australian phenomena. They're part of a wider global mood. But at the same time, what strikes me is that there are also very strong countercurrents, an ongoing commitment to multiculturalism, and a real effort, I think, both institutionally and socially to push back against racism and exclusion. So I suppose I see Australia today as holding both impulses at once. There's probably a certain anxiety, but also a deep-rooted openness.
I feel like you might be saying things that Geraldine Doogue agrees with.
I do.
Yes. Do you agree, Geraldine?
Well, I think you're right about the tussle that occurs within an Australian identity. And actually, that's one of the key things I would like to follow up with you about Indonesian identity. I mean, I think if you look around the world, it just seems that these identity wrestling matches are happening everywhere, possibly as a result of globalization. I mean, I find it very interesting how this is happening in all sorts of places. Now, how would you, like the Indonesian identity, which is hard for Australians to fully grasp, but can seem quite elusive, I think. You don't have to agree with me, but that's how it seems to me. How do you see it reflected in the arts, in the choices people are making to express themselves, what they spend money on?
I think, well, one way of answering it is to look at how a sense of belonging, first of all, has shifted across generations, yeah? I mean, I grew up with a very strong sense, almost a moral imperative, that if you were given the privilege to study or live abroad, you would return. You know, the idea of like giving back. Now, my parents had lived in Europe. They spoke several languages. They moved very comfortably across cultures. But coming home was never in doubt. And that expectation, in a way, was passed on to me. But when I look at my daughter's generation, I see something quite different. My daughter, for instance, grew up across cultures, studied, and now lives in the United States. She's married to an American. She's had a steady job she loves since she graduated from college almost a decade ago. And there was never an expectation for me that she had to return, and she hasn't. But what moves me is that she has chosen to remain Indonesian. She still holds on to that identity, even as she lives very, very fully elsewhere. I mean, I'd like to think that she's become American. I mean, I sometimes just don't know how to talk to her. But what has changed, I think, is that belonging is no longer assumed, right? And it's chosen. Now, younger Indonesians today are far more global in their orientation, and they're more connected, more fluent in international conversations, more at ease, moving across borders, physically and culturally. And many of them see themselves quite naturally as citizens of the world. But that doesn't necessarily mean a loss of identity. What it means perhaps is that identity is no longer tied to geography in the same way.
Lakshmi, we've been trying to explore and understand where Indonesia is today and where it's going. And there's a version of this story, which is the economic forecast, which paint a very rosy picture of where Indonesia is headed. And you can see the riches emerging here on the streets, certainly of Jakarta anyway. But then when I talk to Indonesians, there's a slightly glum feeling.
Right.
A nervousness, a fear about whether President Prabowo is genuinely committed to democracy, whether perhaps some of the advancements that have been made might now be in reverse gear. What do you observe? How do you observe all of that?
No, that is very relevant to what's happening today, what I see happening today, what I feel. In the air, there is this growing ambivalence, right? And in recent years, particularly with the wave of youth protests we saw in 2019 and again in the second half of last year, you see a generation that is very articulate, very politically aware, very clear about their rights and expectations. But alongside that, there's also a deepening skepticism. Because among many young Indonesians, especially those who have studied abroad or come from more educated or urban backgrounds, there's a sense that returning home does not always guarantee recognition or even safety, and that merit is not always rewarded, that institutions may not protect you. It's not that they care less, it's that they trust less, I think. And that creates a kind of quiet dilemma, whether to invest oneself in the country or to build a life elsewhere. And I think Indonesians have always had an outward-looking sensibility, but perhaps not always the means or the confidence to project themselves globally. You see this even in something as simple as food. You know, I mean, Indonesian cuisine is extraordinarily rich and diverse, but it's not nearly as visible internationally as, say, Korean, Thai, or Vietnamese. And part of that, I think, is precisely that diversity. We have so many variations that we sometimes struggle to decide what represents us. We have this extraordinary richness, but we haven't yet learned how to translate that richness into a language the world can easily recognize. Of course, there are exceptions, and I'll get to that. But there is, in a sense, a gap between what Indonesia is and how it is seen. And in the arts and literature, for instance, we're seeing more Indonesian writers and artists and filmmakers gaining international recognition. There are more translations, more exchanges, and more presence, but it's still uneven and often driven by individual effort rather than strong institutional support.
If I understand you correctly, you're also observing that Indonesia is so disparate.
Yeah.
There's not a single identity that it can say to the world, this is us, this is what we are, this is our culture. Within Indonesia, that's a constant wrestle.
Yes. I mean, of course, I mean, the actual essence of Indonesia itself is pluralism. It is very much a political construct. As you know, it's a 20th century modern invention. It cobbles together all these, you know, ways of beings and beliefs and cultures and languages into this oneness. This imagined community, as the late Benedict Anderson has famously coined. But it is also actually very much lived. So we actually really do know how to live with difference. I mean, of course, there have been, you know, tensions and ruptures, but there is that. And so that's one of the things that give me hope that would prevail. But yes, there is no fixed identity. You know, someone who lives and looks very different from you can claim as much Indonesianness as you can. And this sort of lack of fixed identity is what makes us beautiful, but at the same time, so maddeningly ungraspable, and perhaps even to ourselves.
Well, today on our fourth episode of our Indonesia Rising series, and thank you very much for your feedback, we speak to author and poet Laksmi Pamunjak.
The sort of narrative, though, about Indonesia is that there is a move towards more religious fundamentalism.
Right.
That it's becoming more conservative generally as a country, whether it is Catholicism or Islam. But it strikes me being here that it's actually a bit more nuanced than that.
Yes. Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, I see this, for instance, from the appetite for a lot of podcasts these days that are focused on women's issues, women's lived experiences. And those who have come forward and who have agreed to becoming a source, you know, to be interviewed in these podcasts, they speak very, very freely and very openly about marital problems, about problems with boyfriends and even to, you know, to darker and deeper problems within any given formal sort of, you know, arrangement.
Can I ask you about the way Indonesia is understanding itself through its history? Because Prabowo's government has tried to formally rewrite the nation's history, and it's tried to excise certain key moments. Some of those key moments relate to Prabowo's own role, you know, towards the end of the Suharto New Order regime, where there are very serious accusations. But it's not just that they've tried to remove from the history books. Your first book was very specifically about a chapter of Indonesia's history that was hidden, the campaign against communists and ultimately just against leftists that saw something like a million people killed in the 60s. Mm-hmm. And it focuses on Buru Island, which became a prison camp, a place of terrible suffering. Do you think you could write that book today under Prabowo's rule?
It's actually a very difficult question, and I think the answer is not entirely straightforward. If I'm being precise, I would say that the evidence does not necessarily suggest that there is more formal censorship now than there was before. even in the democratic period after the fall of Suharto during the SBY years, during the Jokowi years. But writers and artists in Indonesia have, in fact, continued to engage with very difficult and sensitive histories. My own novel, as you just mentioned, Amba, that was published in 2012. And it did deal with the mass killings of 1965-68. And since then, there have been other works, both literary and in film, that returned to similarly painful subjects. And of course, they're all aware of what risks they are taking. Because what is striking is, of course, that this is happening at a time when President Prabowo, who has long been associated in the public imagination with that period as the former commander of the special forces, is now the sitting president. So in that sense, one could say that it remains possible for artists and writers to engage even with subjects that are politically and historically very charged. And on the specific topic of communism, there are also recent works in literature, such as a novel by a new writer called Adeste Adiprianti, that revisit the experience of those accused of being communists and which have been, you know, published without obstruction. So it'd be difficult to argue that censorship in a formal or systematic way has significantly tightened. But at the same time, there have been incidents that give one pause. I mean, there's this case, I don't know whether you've heard, the stand-up comedian who recently faced threats of prosecution after criticizing the government in a televised performance on a Netflix program, I think. And there have been periodic pressures also on exhibitions and public programming.
Lakshmi, we've been talking on and off while I've been here, and you've expressed some concern to me that you haven't been hopeful enough about your country. So I wonder, given all the problems, all the frailties, all of the challenges that clearly exist in Indonesia, how do you feel about your country? Like, are you more hopeful than not?
I think if you live long enough in any country, especially one as complex as Indonesia, you learn that hope, you know, it's never a constant state. I mean, it comes and goes, and there are moments when, you know, you feel deeply troubled, even disheartened, and even very, very angry. There are many, many things that give me pause these days, you know, that really, really trouble me with what's going on. But I wouldn't say I lose hope. I cannot, you see, because part of that has to do with what I still believe to be the essence of Indonesia that I mentioned earlier, which is pluralism. Because for the most part, even after being tested repeatedly, we have found ways, however imperfect, to live alongside one another. And then there is the cultural life of the country, which I find genuinely heartening. Because if you look at what's happening in literature, for instance, there are Indonesian writers whose work is increasingly traveling, being translated, read, and discussed internationally. It just suggests a literary culture that is both rooted and outward-looking. And in film, at a time when so many films are being made and more international collaborations are taking place, although much of the industry is still driven by the market, you also have works of real aesthetic ambition. Films like Pangku recently, it really, really absolutely floored me. And then there's the work of directors like Joko Anwar, Race, Islam, and Power by Andreas Harsono. So that goes to your questions now. I mean, you really do have to sit down with Andreas Harsono. It's a very important account of how religion, ethnicity, and politics intersect in the post-Suharto period, as you probably know. And then if I may be allowed...
You're outdoing Geraldine Doogue with the recommendations, I've got to be honest. Because
last one, Lakshmi.
Of course, it will be Pramuja Anantatur, especially the Buru Tetralogy, you know, as well as the Mute Soliloquy, his memoir from prison. Because in many ways, he remains essential to understanding how history, power, and storytelling are entangled in Indonesia.
Lakshmi, thank you so much. It's been really good to talk to you. You've been really generous.
Likewise. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been wonderful. Bye-bye. Well, Hamish, what a delight she was. You know, a completely different perspective to that which we generally get from Indonesia, which is why I loved it so much.
Something I've learnt from you, Jerry, is to always look at what the culture, what the simple things, what the small things, what the books, what the films, what the attitudes tell you about the bigger picture. And I think, you know, as I look at this place today, I think you can see that connective tissue. Clearly, there's element of doubt and concern that was very clear from what Lakshmi was saying. But there is also a passion. There's an ambition. There's a pride. And, you know, I suppose the thing about Indonesia, which I'm reminded of, and, you know, sometimes it makes the Indonesia story difficult to tell for an Australian audience, is that you can't neatly package it up and just say it's one thing. When you have this vast archipelago, all these different languages and cultures and different foods and different attitudes, different faiths, it's not a flat culture. It's not something that you can simply articulate and describe. When you think about our challenges in describing what our culture is in Australia, and we're a country of 25 million people, well, Jakarta alone is 42 million people. So imagine what this place of almost 300 million, imagine the challenge in trying to wrestle that into one homogenous description.
Look, I still think it is interesting for us, though. I think I said many weeks ago that Dr. Jamie Mackey, the marvellous commentator from the past, said, we have to aim to be very good neighbours, but we won't be necessarily intimate partners, Australia and Indonesia. And that is a good enough sort of relationship. And all that you're telling me and all the interviews you've brought us, I think I'm sort of settling back and listening to that again, that particular verdict.
You see, I think that's a really interesting verdict for you to raise, because Willy Sabander, the guy that was, you know, became the very famous CEO of the Jakarta Metro, now the chair of the Indonesia Business Council, he takes a different position on exactly what you're describing. He says it does have to be a marriage. He wants it to be a marriage. He says it's a mistake to think of us as just siblings. We're not actually brothers. Indonesia, Malaysia, Indonesia, Philippines, maybe we're siblings. But we're quite different, and we need to think about the fact that we come to this relationship with really big differences, and that actually you have to go through that kind of marital process of learning each other in a deeper and more intimate way for it to be a success. We can't just sit back.
How interesting. Now, that is very thought-provoking. We're not there yet, is what I'd say.
Well, Geraldine, happily, we've had heaps of feedback on the Indonesia series so far. Rob Ritchie writes, so pleased to hear about the focus on Southeast Asia and the neighbourhood. It's been some time, though, since Nicholas Moore's report. It would be great to have an update on progress by government and its agencies and whether the private sector has noticed much change. Export Finance Australia has been in the news a lot lately as the agency involved. EFA also features in Moore's report. It'd be good to understand what this agency actually does and whether it's delivering bang for buck in terms of our objectives in the region. A skim through at the board and executives suggest there are very few real regional expertise and long tenures. Is it time for a shake-up? Rob says, love the pod, although I do miss you on Saturday morning. Any chance you could move to 7 days a week?
Rob.
You're giving Jerry a heart attack.
He is indeed.
Look, just to let you know, we are actually going to have a final episode of this mini-series with the current serving Australian ambassador to Jakarta. Really fascinating man, Rod Brazier. I think you'll look forward to that conversation, but I reckon we should try and find Nick Moore for a future episode as well.
Oh, I couldn't agree with you more.
Yeah, look, thank you for the feedback. Keep it coming. global.roaming@abc.net.au is the email address. And by the way, Lakshmi Parmenchuk has provided us with a brilliant reading recommendation list. If you want to know
very
more,
long.
It is long. We're going to put it in the show notes. If you want to know about Indonesia, please take a look at that. And by the way, I'm going to recommend her book, The Question of Red, which I referred to at the beginning. It's beautiful.
Yeah, well, I just don't think you can go past Year of Living Dangerously, which I know is probably a little bit standard, but it was such a marvellous book and film.
Okay. See you next time.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.